Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, this is Tom Nunn. I'm president of Tom Nunn Consulting, and happy to be here today.
Tom, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Excited about the conversation that you and I had planned, a lot to cover. But first things first, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Okay. I started out my career a long time ago. I spent a little over 20 years in multinational banks. Most of that was leading either large operations groups or information technology groups, supporting the bank's Wall Street or global markets functions. It was actually in the IT groups that I ran for some large banks in the 90s where I became acquainted with IT contractors, more from the buying side. I joined a mid-size IT staffing company in 2000. I helped grow it to from about 25 million to a little over 100 million. I left as the president in 2009 after we had sold the company. So I had a terrific run there, very fulfilling. Shortly after I left, I started my own consulting business later in 2009. I focused primarily on helping professional staffing companies grow. I focus on what I call 10 best practices of a healthy company, and I'll jump into that in a little more detail later on. Since starting my business in 2009, I've worked with a bit over 110 staffing companies all over the US, mostly small to mids, but then a few very large ones. And then last but not least, I have served on the board of directors for TechServe Alliance. It's a national association for IT and engineering staffing companies headquartered in Washington, D.C. I started there in 2009 on the board, and in 2011 was elected secretary treasurer and member of the executive committee, and I still serve in that capacity today.
Wow, that's super exciting and very, very diverse and colorful career. Thank you for sharing that. So having spent quite a few years in talent acquisition and staffing space, and given the work you currently do with your own consulting firm, you must research, you must observe a lot of the different trends that are happening in this space. What are you mostly excited about when it comes to trends in staffing and talent acquisition? What are you observing? What are you mostly excited about?
Well, the trends that I see are, some of them are pretty obvious to folks that have been in this industry for a long time. The larger buyers of of our services tend to lead us down the commodity path with MSP programs and those sort of things. A trend that I'm seeing there is companies that are in that business have really worked hard to realign their compensation programs, particularly on the account management side, so that where they're getting relatively low margins, they can still make a decent profit because they've got their cost and compensation structures in line. A very specific trend that everybody is going through right now is demand has probably never been higher when it comes to job orders, requisitions. No one is crying the blues that they're not getting enough job orders. Everyone is concerned, if you will, about I don't have enough recruiting horsepower. The average for high touch firms that are bringing in relationship type job orders, the average recruiter to sales ratio has gone from maybe 1.5 to 2 or 3 per salesperson over the last couple of years. So recruiting is getting harder and harder to find enough of that. I think the some of the technology innovation trends that I'm seeing is, and I spend quite a bit of time talking with my customers on this. I have, in addition to a lot of consulting customers, I also run peer group roundtables that are organized by company size. And every single one of them spends some time talking about their tech stack, talking about some of the automation, some of the things that are coming along that they need to stay in touch with. So to touch on a few of those, the artificial intelligence, things like chatbots, things that are taking very routine tasks that a salesperson or recruiter might do and automating it. There are things like HearFish and Sense, which are two pretty well-known tools that are out there that help enhance the onboarding of consultants I wouldn't call it mundane because it's important, but for lack of a better term, some of the mundane keeping up with them tasks and keeping things going. So that's all what they call artificial intelligence. It's a computer doing the work, and that certainly makes things more efficient. Also, some of those tools that help with database integrity. I'm a data person. I've always been a data person, and I can't tell you how often I'll work with a company that I'll say, you know, if you begin to look at this data more specifically, particularly if it's high level data, it'll really help you out as an executive. And then they go and do the work and they say, I can't rely on the data because it's not being input consistently or the data's all messed up. So a lot of work to make sure that, and some AI to help with keeping the database updated and making sure there's good integrity there. Chatbots. I remember distinctly the first time that I didn't even know I was talking to a chatbot. I was sitting in my car, took a call, and it was from a person asked me if I was interested in being an Uber driver. And it took me about 45 seconds because I kept on responding. And then what I thought was a human would respond back. And it took me 45 seconds or a minute to realize I was talking to a chatbot. And then I started playing with it. I know I look real young, but I'm on the older side and older generation. And I'm not a big fan of interacting with chatbots. And I remember talking with several people on this over the last couple of years. And they said, well, Tom, you know, you're of the older generation, the younger generation, however you define that, are perfectly comfortable talking with chatbots. And that does some of the work. So I accept that at face value. You know, one of the things that I'm actually pretty involved with TechServe and some of the things they're rolling out, but they've got a very exciting partnership they've got going with a company called Verimark. And it's really making background checks very much more efficient. I do a lot of work with CFO types, and they're always lamenting the fact that onboarding a consultant takes too long, particularly in this environment where if it takes 3 weeks to get a darn background check back because of all the work that has to happen, oftentimes they'll lose the candidate that says, I'll take the offer, but then you're too late because it takes too long to do background checks. So the exciting thing that's going on there is something called a career passport. And I'm really excited for this. I think it's going to take some acceptance on the client side. But what it does is you do a very thorough background check for a consultant. You could do it on an employee. And that's going to take some time. But then the Verimark put something together called a career passport, and it's blockchain encrypted. So it might go back 10 years and do all the various background checks. As a consultant, I've got my background check. Then 6 months later, I go to another gig, and that employer wants a background check. Well, guess what? You've only got to go back 6 months if they accept this, because it's blockchain encrypted and it can't be changed, so that you're just getting an incremental backup. I think that's ingenious. And if that helps shorten the time frame for doing background checks, it's going to enhance the ability to get people up to work. I think it's also from an innovation perspective, and whether you call this innovation or not, I will. A lot of what I do in my consulting business, and yes, I've got a lot of experience in the professional staffing world with talent acquisition because I've been in that industry for 20 years. But I really marry that up with stuff that's really generic. It's what do you do to build a company? How do you build a company in value? You know, a very interesting statistic is at least in TechServe, where I'm very involved, we've got about 325 members, of which 80% are under 20 million and 67% are under 10 million. It doesn't take a lot of capital. It really takes some entrepreneurship and some chutzpah to start a staffing company. And you get to that first 5 million. It's that much harder to get to 10, and it's that much harder to get to 20. And I would guess that there's only less than 5% of the industry of thousands of companies that are over $100 million. It takes some hard work. So I do something called the 10 best practices of healthy companies. And I'm going to read these off pretty quickly. We could spend three more webinars diving deep into those, and that's not for today. Right. But the 10 best practices of healthy companies, in a nutshell, are they develop and maintain a desirable culture. They follow effective hiring practices. They have effective accountability systems. They have consistent and effective compensation systems that emphasize pay for performance. They develop a high-performance leadership team. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later, I think, in the webinar. They use key performance metrics to measure things. They hold productive and compelling meetings. They have efficient and scalable operations and administration. And they have effective planning and goal setting. So I'm sure you'd all agree that there's nothing whatsoever specific to talent acquisition or staffing with those 10 best practices. They're all pretty generic. But these truly are maybe not the only 10, but some of the 10 most important things for companies to focus on getting better at if they want to go from that 5 million to 10 million to 20 million and 50. And then really to do that, you got to throw in a heavy heavy dose of discipline, because these oftentimes take one out of their comfort zone and requires discipline. I also think it's important when we talk about trends to talk about remote work trends. Remote work is arguably here to stay. Everybody was really forced into that at the beginning of COVID. I can tell you from personal experience, prior to about February or March of 2020, I could probably count on one hand the number of video meetings that I was in. And then I started doing, Zoom and GoToMeeting and Teams and getting in video meetings. And I'll have to say the first half a dozen of those were a little bit, took a little bit of getting used to. And now I am just so used to it. And I do 10 or 15 a week. It's cut down on my plane travel. It's made things more efficient. And I think that's here to stay. I've heard some really, really good things in the staffing industry. Of salespeople that say, you know, I don't have to jump in the car and do a two-hour commute to Manhattan or downtown LA. I can talk to my customer via a video chat. So that's here to stay. And in fact, one of the things that's happening with remote work from two perspectives. One, a lot of people aren't going to change jobs and go to another staffing company if they're not allowed to at least work some of their days at home. And then on the consultant side, there are many consultants these days that are saying, I will only take a job if I'm allowed to do it remotely. And that's opened up middle America, if you will, to people that live in Boise, Idaho, for example, that have no desire to go to Manhattan or San Francisco or Dallas to do a gig, but the customer is perfectly comfortable with them doing it remote. Some of the those are some of the trends that I'm really seeing. What I'll say is one trend that I'm very excited about, and this has literally nothing to do with staffing, and that's something called mRNA, messenger RNA. For those of you that know what that is, That was a technology that was used for the COVID vaccine. I have to tell you that I was good in math and history and all that stuff in high school. I wasn't very good with biology, but I read a book last fall called The Codebreaker by Walter Isaacson, who's one of my favorite authors. And it's all about starting in 2012, 2013, the competitiveness and how messenger RNA developed and how that really brought the on the COVID vaccine. And the reason I mentioned that is toward the end of the book, and it really just hit me big time. He basically says the what microchips, where they were in the late 50s and early 60s is where mRNA is right now. The digital revolution and the genetic revolution are marrying up. So obviously that has nothing to do with staffing it per se, but it's fascinating, one of the worldwide innovations that's coming along.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And it, coincidentally, I was recently reading an article about relating to mRNA about, I believe her name is Dr. Carrico, where she basically has been working on this for many, many years, most of her career. And even when the grants were actually pulled and she didn't have any more funding to continue the research, she actually still kept going and going and proving that technology. So that's been kind of just very interesting how after so many years of development and research, it only came about just recently as an actual, you know, something that actually works. So that definitely resonates on so many levels. And you also talked briefly about, you know, the challenges in the staffing space and talent acquisition, especially now with organizations opening up, you know, opportunities on a fully virtual scale, which brings another set of challenges for companies to be able to operate and build, as well as lead high performing hybrid teams on a global scale, whether you have, you know, fully virtual team or whether you have half on-site on-prem and half that fully virtual. Curious to get your thoughts on that perspective as you perhaps consult with your client organizations from that standpoint. What are some of the thoughts and some of the strategies that you share with them on building and leading high performing teams on that global scale?
Well, I actually do a lot of work in that. That's one of the 10 best practices is really two of them. They have strong people and team development systems, and they have good effective hiring practices. And I'd love to talk about both as we go through this afternoon. I think one of the cornerstones of success for a growing company is to focus on high performance teams. And high performance teams can be, high performance teams can be your sales and recruiting teams. Companies that thrive in this business, sales and recruiting work as partners. And there's excellent teamwork. They push each other like good teammates should do, but there's excellent teamwork. Low performing teams, which can really be detrimental to a staffing company's growth, are when sales blames recruiting, when they don't get the fill, and recruiting blames sales for bringing in bad job orders, which is why they can't make any money. So high performance teams are that. I do a lot of work with what I call leadership teams, which are executive teams. And I actually have a survey that I do with executive teams, and we use that as a basis for improving. So I've got something I'm going to read off fairly quickly or touch on very quickly, which is the 10 characteristics of high performance teams. In no particular order, number one, they understand the purpose of the team and are focused on results. If you've got a leadership team and it's made up of the head of sales, the head of that branch, the head of recruiting, the CFO, the CEO, you know, with six or eight people on it, the team is the company. So they understand the purpose of the team and they're focused on results. There's a strong team culture with a general lack of a separate agenda. That really feeds into that as well. I don't have an agenda where I'm going to throw you under the bus. We're going to work together. High level of trust between teammates. I know that my teammates are going to compliment me when I do a good job. And I also know that they'll professionally call me out when I need to do better. They follow team norms and are comfortable calling out non-norm behavior. I do a lot of work on something called what are the norms of conduct on any team. They're accountable to the team and support team decisions outside of the team. One of the norms when I was in the business is speak up now if you disagree, and we'll talk it through. We may agree to disagree, and then as a team, we're going to go in this direction. But once we do that, you support the decision. You don't need to say, I agreed with the way we're going to move forward, but you need to say, but we talked about it, and I agree with the decision, or excuse me, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I support it. They practice and are good at open communication and productive conflict. I use productive conflict all the time, and that is conflict could be defined as when there's two or more opinions on something. Productive is we talk about it productively. I use the term be direct with respect. You need to know exactly where I'm coming from and how I'm feeling, but I'm going to do it very respectfully. When there's productive conflict, great things happen. They're made up of and are tolerant of diverse styles within the team. You know, stereotypically, an entrepreneurial CEO is different from a CFO. Whether you could argue that their brains are made up differently, and we don't necessarily have to go there, but they have different ways of thinking and approaching things. Teams are very accepting, and in fact, the best teams are made up of people of all different types of styles, because it will bring out the best. They're comfortable putting any issue on the table. I got to tell you, I've been in some leadership team meetings where some really tough issues got put on the table, oftentimes about someone maybe even on the team that probably was going to be let go, but you got to deal with it. You got to put tough issues on the table. When they meet, there's a general lack of hierarchy being observed. This starts with the owner or CEO sitting in the meeting. If he or she doesn't allow or people are not comfortable disagreeing with him or her, all is lost. So when you meet, in fact, there's something in when you meet, there could be two or three levels starting with the owner in the meeting. Egos are left at the door, ranks are left at the door, and everybody has an equal say and everybody's very, very comfortable. In fact, I also do a lot of leadership training and our leadership coaching, what I say to, if you're the leader in the room, give your opinion last. If you give it first, any subordinate in the room, even if they trust you, has to filter through their brain. Do I want to disagree with Tom? So if you want to get the honest answers from someone, ask them their opinion first. Don't give your opinion first. Last but not least, there's an ongoing assessment and continuing focus on how they perform as a team and as individuals on the team. I said in my introduction that I was fortunate to be in a company that grew from 25 to over 100 million. And I'll have to say we put in an awful lot of work developing a high-performance leadership team, and that was certainly one of the most important reasons why we're able to grow. I also use something when I'm I could use this when I'm look when I'm helping someone hire somebody, or when we talk about self-improvement, because everybody should be spend a little bit of time on self-improvement. But good teams are made up of people that have a trait called vulnerability. I like a particular definition of vulnerability that says someone that's comfortable being vulnerable is open to and capable of being emotionally wounded. People in teams that accept vulnerability as a valuable trait people that, that are comfortable being vulnerable, it's easy for them to say, I don't know the answer. I made a mistake. I need help. Your idea is better than mine. And from a team perspective, teams that are comfortable being vulnerable can say, we're not doing a very good job with that. We need to change the way we're doing something. We made a terrible mistake and we've got to fix it. Someone that's incapable of being vulnerable, and we've all been around them in our lives. They've always got the right answer. They'll never say, I'm sorry. And so vulnerability is an absolute key trait. And to improve on almost anything, and I use this in my personal life, my professional life, and in my coaching life, the concept of get comfortable being uncomfortable. Anybody that's listening to this podcast, jot that down. It is so, so important. And, you know, the way I think about that, and I oftentimes have to really think about this, is when I've got to approach something that makes me really nervous, I really don't want to deal with it. You know, it could be if I'm in the business, having a hard conversation with someone that doesn't take hard conversations very well. Then I sometimes I might ask advice of somebody. Sometimes I might look up something, even an article, you know, on how to approach this. But then, you know, I take some deep breaths and I go in and I approach it. And I approach something in the way that either I've learned how to approach it. And I'm usually come away from that saying, wow, that worked a whole lot better than I might have anticipated. And I'm incrementally more comfortable to deal with that the next time around. One of the things that is very common is someone that's a leader that chooses something called harmony over conflict. So they'll push conflict under the rug because they're not comfortable dealing with that. The more comfortable that they get with how to deal with anybody, how to call someone out, you know, politely. I call it direct with respect, and the more comfortable they are at dealing with accountability and letting someone know exactly where they need to get better. I think all of these things take practice and focus, but results can be very, very significant, both personally from a self-improvement perspective and from a team improvement perspective.
Right, right, absolutely. And when it comes to, you know, talent acquisition, especially in the past couple of years, has been of, you know, top of the minds for a lot of executives at organizations of various size, because thinking that now we're shifting fully virtual environments, things may get easier, but at the same time, the competition 10x with organizations targeting, you know, very similar, if not the same skill set. But when we add another layer of complexity to that, when it comes to retaining that top talent, is a completely different side of the spectrum. What are your thoughts on that? What are some of the strategies that you provide or recommend to some of your portfolio companies when it comes to retaining the top talent in this highly competitive environment?
Well, I think it's a great question. It's something that a lot of folks do well, and some folks struggle with. And I'll try to keep the answer relatively short. I could probably talk for a couple of hours on this because it's very, very important. And the trend right now is there's a lot of people available on the market that have great looking resumes, but they're really not very good. I think we're going to talk a little later on about hiring best practices, so I'll get more into that. But the way to keep top talent, one is you got to pay them competitively. And I'm a big believer. I do a ton of compensation planning in my business. And I've seen probably 1,000 different compensation plans, some of them good, some of them absolutely terrible. But in my mind, someone that we want to attract, particularly from a producer, a sales or recruiter, salary is important to them, but it's not the most important. The upside is what's most important. So, you know, you got to have a decent market salary. But it's the upside. I want to attract people that say, you know, I'm happy coming in for a $60,000 salary, but I want to make $360,000. So tell me more about your commission plan if I can really produce. So you want to have a good competitive commission plan that has unlimited upside for people that can produce. Another aspect is, what is your culture like? You know, we talked about culture, and I do surveys on those best practices, and I might, someone might give straight, you know, A+ to our culture, and I'll say why, and they'll say, because it's fun, it's ethical, it's a happy place to work. And those are certainly important aspects of a culture, but I just have to really probe a little bit before they'll say, oh, maybe I give myself a B or a B minus. I'll say, is your culture highly accountable? Do people do what they're expected to do? And when they don't, when they do, are they rewarded? Not just compensation wise, but with recognition wise. When they don't, are they gently at first and then strongly, if it doesn't work, told that their job is on the line if they don't do better? One of the common things, which is terrible in our industry, is if you're a $1 million producer, you're the best salesperson in the company, but you're absolutely obnoxious. Recruiters love you when they're placing your people because they're making money off you. They can't stand you when you're telling when the salesperson is yelling and screaming at them. Well, owners that let their best producers money wise stay on the bus begin to lose some really decent people, because your culture is, if you produce great dollars, you can break the rules. You don't have to follow the rules. You can be a lousy teammate because I'm addicted to your dollars. That's not good. So you'll lose people if you're also good people. Great people want to be surrounded by good and great people, and that gets into your hiring best practices. You know, you could get into things like what kind of flexibility does someone have to work remotely? That's a relatively recent, trend, which we just talked about. But I think that if someone is making good money, they feel well paid, particularly with their upside. They think they've got a decent salary. They love the culture because it is fun and it is ethical, but they're surrounded by other fun and ethical people and good teammates. And it's an accountable culture. You're not going to lose, that many people. So that's really one of the ways I look at that. One of the trends that not a week goes by that I don't hear someone talking about it. It used to be, going back a couple of years, that your B and C players on the recruiting side would go to corporate America, and they go from making a $60,000 salary, and maybe they're making $20,000 in commissions because they're not all that good, and they go for an $85,000 salary at ABC Corp. They become a corporate recruiter. So we used to lose the people that wanted the high salary, not much upside. And most people said, you know, nice person, but they weren't a great recruiter. Good luck. Now they're losing some darn good recruiters that are going for, 100, 130, 150 to Facebook and those places. And what I can tell you is that's a tough pill to swallow, but I've yet to talk with the CEO that said, I'm going to match that person's salary at 130,000. I don't know if that trend will continue. I was talking to someone the other day that said, someone went for a pretty big salary, 9 months ago to corporate America. The owner was keeping up with that person that said, I put 26 people to work in the last 6 months. Basically what it came down to was, okay, I got 26 resumes because it was a well-known company. I got 1,000 resumes. I sorted through a bunch of them. I passed them on to the hiring manager. I got 26 starts, no commissions, but 26 starts. So I don't want to say that recruiters in corporate America aren't any good. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying that recruiters that are money motivated and want unlimited upside, same thing with sales. So anyway, I don't want to get too long winded on that, but it's definitely a trend. Your culture and how good or how not good it is an absolute important thing to retaining your talent.
Right, absolutely. No, that makes perfect sense. And with the amount of research and you know that you do for your line of work, I'm curious to get an insight into your content diet or information diet that you prescribe to. What are the different sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself informed and educated on all things going on in your space?
Well, it's the, I got to think about that. The I don't watch a lot of TV. I've got nothing against TV. I just don't watch a lot of it. I'd rather be buried in a book. I read at least two or three books a month. I have a combination. I love historical fiction. I read more than my fair share of spy thrillers for fun. And then I try to read at least two a quarter, just books on self-improvement or things that I can use to help in my consulting business. So I read a lot. The internet, I don't know what I did before the internet. I'm obviously old enough to remember before there was an internet. But it is so easy just to Google something. And I probably have 1,000 documents that I've downloaded. I'm very careful to put the title of the document and the author because I never want anybody to think that I'm the author. But I probably have well over 1,000 documents that are one or two pages long that I've got all organized by subject that I can look at any time. And I use it all the time. But I was just reading one today on it was a two-page document. In fact, I'll give it to everybody on the podcast. I got to find it. Google 12 powerful habits of a lifelong learner. It's going to show up on page one. It's by a gentleman who I don't know named Oscar Nowick, N-O-W-I-C. And number one, I read on a daily basis. Number two, I attend various courses. Number three, they actively seek opportunities to grow. Google it and take a look at that and circle the ones that you do and the ones that you don't do, but you might want to do. So that's, I think one of my probably most important things that is just in my DNA, and I think I got this, I know I got this from my dad. I'm infinitely curious. I love to learn. I'm a lifelong learner. I know more useless trivia than most people, but I also know some very, very things I consider very, very interesting. So not a day goes by that I don't learn something. By the way, I think that's one of the absolute key areas to probe on when you're interviewing people to hire. Mm-hmm. One of the other trends in the industry, to go off on a tangent for a second, is a lot of companies are no longer hiring, saying you got to have talent acquisition experience because there's so many rejects that have a great looking resume, but they've run out of gas and they come in for these big guarantees and they don't produce anything. So the other trend, which is very interesting, is a lot of the real big companies historically would hire people right out of college. They do a lot of campus recruiting. Even that is becoming less and less common. So the trend that I'm seeing very distinctly, whether it's a very large company or even small companies, is I'm looking for someone that might be 2, 3, 4 years out of college. Because people coming right out of college, oftentimes it takes them a year to figure out what they really want to do with their careers. So you run the risk of them saying, well, staffing's not for me. So bringing someone in that's got 2, 3, 4 years, sometimes more, maybe they were in a hype, a sales functor that had dial all day and meet people and all that, and then you can bring them on. But I think that they're looking for more generic skills, someone that's got this curious, someone that likes to learn, someone that has high EQ. By the way, if you don't know what EQ is, people that are listening, it's emotional intelligence. And it's one of the more fascinating things you're going to look at. EQ in general is someone with as high an EQ is superb at understanding how someone likes to be dealt with, within the first 30 seconds of meeting you, and that's how they tailor their interaction. They're very likable, they easily connect, and they can hold on a conversation with almost anybody. Tell me that that doesn't fit someone that's a great recruiter or a great salesperson in our industry. So yeah. Someone that's got high EQ, someone that's got great motivators, they can articulate their motivators, and someone that can convince you they like to learn. I also like to probe on vulnerability. Again, we could go on and on and on you know, what are the
for great, sure. What are we the can probably do a we can probably do a round two on that specific topic, which is definitely very fascinating, very interesting. So I appreciate you bringing that up. And Tom, in conclusion, what is one book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Well, I had a hard time on that one because I was doing a little prep on some of the questions I knew you were going to ask me. And when it comes to something that would be good for you and good for your company, how about I narrow it down to my favorite author and two of my favorite books. Patrick Lencioni is, I've read every one of his books going back 20, 25 years. My two favorites are The Ideal Team Player, which he came out with maybe 5 years ago. You got to read the book, and you got to Google Ideal Team Player, and you could get some stuff on there on how do you interview for the Ideal Team Player, how do you assess. And the second one that he wrote that is probably my second favorite is The Five Temptations of the CEO, but it's really The Five Temptations of anybody that deals with others. So how's that? I narrowed it down to one author and two of my favorite books from that author.
I love it. And definitely can't go wrong with Lencioni's books. Always a great treat. Tom, can't thank you enough for your time today. It was very short and insightful conversation, at least for me. You were very generous with the information that you had shared. What I like doing with all the podcast guests is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if everything that we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.